This is The Country Hour, and you're with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Great to have you along this Thursday afternoon. Remember those green snails that were found in a few punnets of WA strawberries that were shipped over to Tasmania? That was earlier this month, and it led to a ban on WA strawberries going into Tasmania. Well, that's now been lifted, but there are some series of import conditions that need to be met before WA strawberries can go into Tasmania. But it is open. There's sort of like a 2 kilometre zone around those farms in Wanneroo where the green strawberries came, the green snails were found in those strawberries. And we'll talk about that in some detail with the chair of the Strawberry Growers Association of WA. That's after 12:30 when we check in with the news headlines and a look at the weather around Western Australia. And proponents of carbon farming are convinced the carbon price can only go in one direction, and that's up. An Outback Carbon Farming Conference was held in Perth yesterday, and Richard Hudson went along to try and find some landholders and companies who might be interested in making money from carbon. Richard joins me in the studio this afternoon. Richard, who was there, and why do they think the price of carbon is going to improve?
Well, there are about 100 delegates, and the demand was actually unexpected by the organisers, mainly because of what's evolving with Western Australia's rangelands region, which represents close to 90% of the state. And we'll have more on that in a moment. But I'm told there are about 20 landholders. So I saw and spoke to about 6 or 7 myself. But there are also representatives from government departments and various organisations that have an interest in carbon farming. And before yesterday's conference, I think most delegates would have been, let's say, optimistic that carbon prices will pick up. But by the end of the day, I'd say most are now more confident they will. Well, that's after hearing experts shed some light on international climate change politics and outcomes from last year's Paris Agreement. But to be honest, Bell, a lot of that detail actually went over my head.
Oh, Richard, that doesn't surprise me in the slightest. But isn't that part of the reason why some farmers are yet to be convinced about carbon farming? Because it is so complex?
Yes, it is. It is very complicated. And at the risk of making it sound even more complicated, in Australia, we've had 3 emissions reduction fund auctions, the latest a few months ago, and that set the carbon price, the carbon credit price, at a new low of just over $10 a tonne. That's the weighted average volume price. But it's not just the complexities. There are also so many variables, and the goalposts keep getting moved. So countries throughout the world, for instance, have agreed to reduce emissions by a certain amount, but then each country has tackled that problem in different ways. One of the speakers yesterday was head of the Carbon Market Institute, which is Australia's leading industry body dealing with climate change and business. His name's Peter Costellis, and he said something that really grabbed my attention. He thinks current carbon policy settings represent a flaw. In other words, future policy settings can only get more onerous.
Well, firstly, the global emissions trajectory is down. The Paris Agreement, where all the countries of the world came together last year, agreed that we were going to lower emissions around the world, and Australia is party to that. So the Australian government has a policy suite to reduce emissions, and that policy suite is actually going to be more effective in the future because our emissions task is going to get more difficult.
At the moment, Australia's targets are maybe not matched to what they should be, to what's been agreed upon internationally. Is that right?
Australia's targets have been set and put into the international domain. What's not consistent with our targets is how our domestic policies are going to deliver on that target. So we have to put in a suite of policies in Australia that actually deliver our international commitments. And so where is our policy in Australia at the moment? One is to fund emissions abatement through the Emissions Reduction Fund. And the other main policy is to put what is called a safeguard mechanism in place, that is a baseline that is put over industry to limit emissions growth for large emitters. Those two policies working together are going to have to get us our international targets.
So what's the message you've been giving to some of the big companies you've been chatting to here in Perth over the last couple of days? Are things going to get tougher?
For big companies, for companies with a large emissions profile, they are going to have to reduce emissions themselves, or they are going to have to purchase carbon credits to meet their emission reduction commitments. So either way, large companies in Australia are going to have to change their practices and their emissions profile. Otherwise, they will have a financial liability under a future evolution of the domestic scheme.
So is this going to increase demand for the private sector to get involved in carbon farming, carbon credits, etc.?
We've had in Australia in the past, under the carbon pricing mechanism, which was under the Gillard government that was brought in, we've had an example whereby large companies in Australia actively purchased carbon farming initiative projects. So credits that were generated on the land were purchased by large companies and we had a functioning market. And since that was repealed under the Abbott government, we are now coming in with a new scheme, which is, again, the safeguard mechanism, which actually will still require large companies to purchase credits generated off the land. But we've actually got some corporate history in doing that. This is not new. So large companies have already participated in purchasing units from credits generated off the land. What we're going to see is a significant increase in that demand. That demand is only going to get more and more, is going to increase, driving more opportunities to generate credits from land-based activities.
So does that mean companies that you chatted to, let's say here in Perth, will be knocking on the door of landholders saying, hey, we'd like to be getting involved with carbon farming with you in some way, shape or form?
I think a lot of large companies are now having the debate internally about how do we go about our emissions reduction challenge? Mm. How do we invest in our own energy efficiency? How do we moderate our own practices? How do we manage our portfolio of operations? And as well, how do we hedge against or protect ourselves against a future cost that we might have? And that involves identifying where they can source domestic credits. And so I think we're going to see many more conversations between large corporates and project developers about could you supply us with credits in the future? That's already happening. That started to happen. But that we're going to see a lot more of that discussion go on.
And what do you actually mean when you say sourcing domestic credits?
That is, you know, the large companies will be the buyers. So if you can generate a carbon credit from, for example, carbon farming activities on the land, that credit will then have value for large corporates and they will be the buyers. At the moment, the government through the Emission Reduction Fund is the main buyer. So it's government publicly funded purchasing of abatement. We're going to see that transition to the private sector being the buyer. And so simply, private companies will have an emission reduction challenge. They will need to buy credits to meet their obligations under future domestic policy.
Peter Costellis, he's the CEO of the Carbon Market Institute. He was in WA advising some of the state's largest companies, but he's also speaking at yesterday's Outback Carbon Farming Conference on the Country Hour, 19 past 12. In the studio with me is Richard Hudson, who was at that conference yesterday. Richard, Peter Costellis is obviously confident the carbon price will go up, and he thinks private companies will start to get interested in carbon farming here in WA. What's the potential? How big can this get?
Well, the WA government has gone on the record saying it's potentially a $1 billion industry, which sounds pretty impressive. But at this stage, I think the key word is still potential because there are just so many unknowns and variables.
Now, this subject can be a little esoteric. So for those not familiar with it, haven't been looking into it in a great deal of detail, in simple terms, what is carbon farming?
I should ask you what esoteric means, but I won't. Carbon farming, it's all about the production and sale of carbon credits under an accredited system. So farming in a way that reduces greenhouse gas emissions. And basically, from what I can gather, it involves capturing and holding carbon in vegetation and soils. All sorts of side benefits to the environment and the farmer's bottom line just with those things alone. But for this discussion, as positive as those things are, they're sort of side issues.
And why is there this talk, this discussion about carbon farming now?
Because historically in WA in particular, we're at a very interesting stage. You might have noticed yesterday's conference was called Outback Carbon Farming. The focus was on Outback WA. In a moment, we'll hear from some landholders from the Pilbara Outback, if you like, who were at yesterday's conference. But one of the speakers was Scott Girdler, a lawyer who specialises in agribusiness. And I asked him if anyone is farming carbon on Crown land in WA right now, in other words, on leasehold land.
No. Why is that? Combination of things. One, the control of the benefit of carbon in Western Australia sits with the state government. And the state government doesn't have policies or procedures that facilitate others getting the benefit of those carbon rights at present. But the first and most obvious reason is that no one's actually asked to start a carbon project on Crown land in Western Australia to this point. There have been no first movers, if you like.
So no one at all has put in a proper formal request?
As far as I know, you need to check that with the state, but that's my information.
But I suppose the obvious thing, which was mentioned today, the elephant in the room, is that rangelands reform process. Is that what is stopping private investment in carbon farming in Western Australia on Crown land?
It's certainly a factor. The rangelands reform proposals involve the new tenure known as a rangelands lease, which is specifically slated to be used under a carbon farming scenario to encourage carbon farming use of land in the rangelands.
Well, Sandra Eckert, you're a lawyer with the Department of Lands. Some of these questions you may not be able to answer, and I fully understand that, but where are we up to with the rangelands reform process? We've heard a lot about it, but is it closer to actually getting pushed through?
Well, we've had a very fulsome consultation process during the first half of this year, and we've got a draft bill. At the moment, it's going through the cabinet process, and I'm not in a position to comment further as to where that's at. But we've certainly done a lot of hard work over about the last 6 to 9 months to get it to a position where it can go forward.
What about the fact that we are nearing the end of the term of this government? Is that potentially a hiccup as well?
Oh, obviously, potentially. I've been working in the carbon area since the early 2000s. These things have their own lives. Obviously, changes of government or not on elections do affect it, but we don't know, obviously, at the moment. We're still on this side of the election. We're still doing our job on this proposal.
That's Sandra Eckert, who's a lawyer representing the Department of Lands. She was answering some pretty tricky questions from the floor yesterday as well. We'll hear more from her and Scott Girdler in a moment.
On the Country Hour, 23 past 12. Richard, you mentioned there were some landholders there. What did they think of the conference?
Well, I reckon by the end of the day, they were probably pretty tired. There was lots of detail. I'm sure they went home with a few headaches. Tom Jackson runs a property at Kew in the Murchison region, about 700 kilometres north of Perth. We've chatted to him on the Country Hour before about the Rangelands Reform Project. He's still very keen to get the carbon farming bandwagon rolling.
It just ticks all the boxes if we can do it. The sequestration of carbon is important, but to do that, you've got to grow a lot more plants and grow them more vigorously. If you're doing that, you're looking after the ecosystem. You've got some income from the carbon, and you're going to have better income if you're running livestock in conjunction. It's an absolute no-brainer. And from what we've been hearing today, the technical side of measuring it is less and less a problem. That's making rapid advances, and the markets are there, and from what we've been told today, they're only going to grow. So,
is there certainty on that? I picked up on that comment that when the carbon price improves, is it your understanding that it definitely will?
Well, just from the point of view that the pressure to deal with carbon is going to continue to increase worldwide, and this is the most logical way to deal with it, I think, you know, the market must go ahead. But the three things that are holding it up are tenure, native title, and who owns the carbon. You know, pastoralists only have rights to graze the country. We don't have rights to the carbon. And how the government deals with that will, you know, determine some of the outcome. I just believe that it's crazy for that not to be given to the pastoralists, because it will have such a tremendous knock-on effect on the country. I mean, our country generally is pretty badly deteriorated. I'm not just talking about my place, but right through the rangelands. And this is the most obvious way to turn that around.
Sandra, is there a chance that through this rangelands reform process that there will be the pastoralist that receives the money for the carbon in the future?
I couldn't comment on who will get it in the future. It's certainly an area that the government hasn't done a lot of policy work on to date, and there's been good reasons for that. But it is an area that's becoming more evident that the time for that policy work is now. And so it's looking at a balance between the state and pastoralists and other interest holders, like native title interest holders in the land, to see where the right balance lies.
John Dunn, you're also from a property. Whereabouts is yours?
Remlap Station is about 80 k's southeast of Payne's Vine and about 50 k's northwest of Beacon.
And how long have you had that one?
We bought the station in about 2000.
Are you interested in the carbon farming side of things for the future, for your property?
Yeah, we certainly are interested in them, and that is what brought us to this conference today. Our situation is quite a bit different to Tom's, for instance. We've only got a very small station. It's only 100,000 acres. And we've got it completely destocked and has been destocked since about 2006. So the vegetation and the quality of the vegetation, and you might say the carbon sink on Remlap, is about as good as it'll get. So we can't really improve that very much. So one of the questions I asked today was, what's in it for us if we're wanting to try and sell our carbon credits or whether the government takes the credit for that? We've already got the station in fantastic condition. We've had wild dogs come down from the north and we've had droughts, and so we've taken the sheep off. We can't put them back on there because we've still got dogs. So we saw the carbon credits as being an opportunity for us to come to this conference and listen to all the speakers. And it's been a wonderful day.
Scott, would you have any idea if there is anything in this carbon farming for someone like John?
That is a question that really depends on the technicalities of whether there's a specific carbon farming initiative methodology that would work for John's situation. There's certainly a lack at the moment of methodologies under which you can generate carbon credits that are suitable for a reasonably large portion of the rangelands. And that's something that's in development and has been in development for some time. For example, there are existing methodologies which probably have no real application to the rangelands in relation to earning carbon credits through avoided deforestation, where you have a right to remove forest but don't do that and therefore earn carbon credits. If we could have a similar methodology which applies to a pastoral lease like John's, where you have a right to graze stock which would reduce the carbon store in the land but choose not to, then it would make logical sense that you could claim carbon credits as part of a methodology for that. As far as I know, there doesn't exist a methodology that facilitates that at the moment.
Who's developing the methodologies? Will it be the state government's task? No?
The federal government would have to be the ones that came up with that. I'd just like to correct John. We actually have had our station destocked from 2003 until about 2012. So we have actually gone through that process. We're now trying to work out how we can put livestock back into the system without taking it backwards again. I mean, the science says that we can actually triple the ground cover and the productivity of the place from where we are now. Worldwide science on rangelands management, if it's managed differently. So I think we've still got a lot of potential there to do carbon as well.
When you talk about different management, are you talking about cell grazing, rotational grazing, those sorts of things?
That sort of thing. I mean, set stocking really destroyed most of the southern rangelands, took out all the palatable perennials, and it was just running on winter annuals, and the seasons, climate change has changed the seasons, and we're just in the process of having our second winter season in 16 years, but we've had some summer seasons, and if we can get our perennials, especially the grasses, back, which we are, then, you know, we can continue to run livestock. But it's a long and complicated thing, and I certainly won't see the end of it. I'm far too old.
Well, John, did you hear enough encouraging things today to convince you that this is the way to go for you?
Well, I think listening to what Tom had to say then, it's we're really looking for a reward for our stewardship of the country. We love the country. We love the vegetation. We don't want to damage it, and we want it to be as good or better than it's ever been. It's never going to get back to what it was a couple of hundred years ago. But I think, Tom, from what you were saying, you're looking after the place as best you possibly can, and you're prepared to adopt whatever methods are needed to do the very best for the vegetation.
Yeah, well, I mean, the stewardship payment side of stuff really just has to be based on the return to improved ecosystems to the whole community. And how do you measure that? I mean, how do you define what an ecosystem service is for a start? But if you can define it and measure it and then value it, then there should be some reward to the producer, the pastoralist, who is actually achieving those things. And stewardship payments have been tried in a number of places, certainly in New South Wales, with a great deal of success. But because of our economic system, we tend not to value things that you can't sell for cash. That's another major issue.
Well, after hearing everything I did today, I still think the big word is potential. There's potential for money to be made out of the carbon credits and out of carbon farming in Western Australia, but there really are just so many variables still and so many things to be finalised. Would you agree with that, Sandra?
Yes, I would, but I'd like to say that the industry is only about 10 years old. So, you know, we've come a long way in 10 years and everybody wants to start off from scratch, you know, first day. But I think we've come a long way. We've still got a long way to go, but we're heading in the right direction, I think.
Some of the people gathered yesterday in Perth for the Outback Carbon Farming Conference. Sandra Eckert, General Counsel, Department of Lands. We also heard from Scott Girdler, Special Counsel for law firm Clayton Utz. John Dunn, farmer and pastoral leaseholder from Payne's Find, which is about 430 kilometres northeast of Perth. And Tom Jackson, he's a pastoralist from Kew in our Murchison region. And that report by Richard Hudson. On the Country Hour, 27 to 1, Rebecca Dollery is in the studio now and she's got news headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. One of WA Labor's longest serving MPs and one of the main drivers behind the party's Metronet policy is quitting state politics. Former Shadow Transport Minister Ken Travers will leave the upper house after next week. Lawyer and Vincent Councillor Lane McDonald will take Mr Travers' spot until the state election. Former State Government Minister Rob Johnson has confirmed he'll contest the next election as an independent. Mr Johnson quit the Liberal Party in April after a bitter falling out with the Premier Colin Barnett following his removal from Cabinet. And the Immigration Minister Peter Dutton has accused the ABC and The Guardian of trivialising claims of abuse on Nauru. The Guardian's recently published hundreds of leaked files, some containing allegations of abuse, sexual assaults and self-harm at the island's detention centre. Mr Dutton says some allegations relate to abuse allegedly by parents or other detainees. Thanks, Bell. More news at 1.
Thank you so much for the update, Rebecca. And it's 26 minutes to 1. News at 1. Before we get to the news today, we're off to Mount Barker. Tracy Kilner will have the results of the cattle market for us today. And we'll also talk about the fact that WA strawberries are now allowed back into Tasmania following those green snails that were found in a few punnets of WA strawberries going back earlier this month. We'll catch up with Neil Handaside. He's the chair of the Strawberry Growers of Western Australia very shortly. First, we're off to the Weather Bureau. And if I just get the right screen up, it's James Ashley on the program today. James, let's take a look around the Southwest Land Division. Still some more rain on the way for parts anyway.
There is, although nothing like the system that's moved through over the last 24 hours. There's still some showers around most of the Southwest Land Division, but most of the shower activity is confined to the south coastal parts, with winds easing right across the board as the front actually has moved into South Australia now. So a real easing trend on the weather over the southern WA, with showers, only pretty light showers over most of the agricultural areas. Couple of decent showers near coastal parts, but generally all that will ease off and clear during the afternoon. By this evening, we're probably only looking at showers along the south coast, and that'll be the situation as we enter Friday morning, with just showers in south coastal parts, maybe pushing up the west coast to about Mandurah. But there is a weak front coming through late Friday, so it gets to the southwest capes Friday evening, pushes across the southwest district and up to sort of Perth to Albany around midnight or so. That'll push showers up as far as about Durian Bay, but only inland to sort of northern during the course of Friday evening. So the vast majority of the southwest land division will be clear tomorrow. The most significant thing probably weather-wise tomorrow is that it's going to be behind yesterday's front. A lot of cold airs come up, and overnight temperatures will get well into the negatives through most inland parts overnight tonight. So probably quite a large area of frost over, certainly over inland parts of the southwest land division tomorrow morning. That front moves through sort of Friday night into Saturday morning. By Saturday morning, it's brushing the sort of Bremer Bay area, moving towards Esperance and clearing the southwest land division by the evening. So showers over most parts of the southwest land division south of a line from about Durian Bay to Southern Cross, and most of them will clear during the afternoon as well as that front moves eastwards. Looks like a bit more activity with the front around the far west, western south coast between Margaret River and Albany on Friday night, and then sort of Esperance eastwards on Saturday afternoon. That's probably the area of any decent falls over those 2 days. Chance of a thunderstorm as well with that front in those areas over Friday and Saturday. But generally, Saturday again, it'll be particularly northern agricultural areas, it'll be pretty cold through there and the chance of some frost. And by the time we enter Sunday, most activity with the Friday night, Saturday morning front has gone. And it's not, we're left with, by Sunday morning, we're left with showers just really near the southwest capes in a westerly flow. But we do have another front coming up. So that front comes through Sunday evening, Sunday night, a little bit stronger than Friday night's system, nowhere near the one we've just had. But the most significant thing about this feature is the cold southerly airstream behind it. So the front itself will increase showers over western parts Sunday night. The chance of a thunderstorm as well with that front as it moves over the southwest corner of the state. By Monday morning, it moves pretty quickly. It's already sort of through Esperance by Monday morning. So most of the action with the front will be overnight Sunday as it moves across the southwest land division, taking showers right through most areas. And then by Monday morning, we've got a cold southerly over the southwest land division. There'll probably be some hail and thunderstorms in that as well, again, across most areas. Certainly south of about Perth to Southern Cross is the chance of hail and thunderstorms in that cold air behind the front. And particularly windy as well, the southerlies will be quite strong. So pretty ordinary conditions, really, across the board from Monday. The front itself clears the southwest land division during the morning, and during the afternoon and evening, most of the showers will contract back to the south coast. So with all that cold air, probably looking at, again, frost around Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning, as the rain clears and we get some more clear skies and cold temperatures.
Certainly a bit of activity. I guess it is winter, after all.
It is. It's kind of seeing some transition into the more spring-type patterns, but these cold outbreaks are continuing, certainly behind Sunday's front.
All right, let's have a look into northern and eastern parts now, James.
Well, that's a lot simpler over the next few days. There's no weather around most areas. Anything with that front through the Eucla is pretty much cleared. Just some showers near the coast now. So for Friday, maybe some showers near the Eucla coast. That's pretty much it. A good blast of southeasterlies through the Pilbara and southern parts of the Kimberley. So that's something for people to look out for. By Saturday, a trough sort of deepens through the Kimberley and into the interior. And of course, across the course of the weekend, there's just a chance we'll get some showers over northern and eastern parts of the Kimberley and that far eastern part of the northern interior. Any rainfall out of that, probably less than a millimetre, so nothing really of any significance, but a little bit of a change in the pattern up there. And those showers continue into Monday across northern parts of the Kimberley. Also with Monday's front, Sunday night, Monday's front, that'll push showers up into the southern half of the Gascoyne, right across the goldfields and through the Eucla and southern interior during the course of Monday. And again, there will be a lot of cold air and quite strong winds in the southerlies behind that front.
And warnings today?
Warning-wise, we've got a sheet weather warning for the southeast coastal district as the showers and winds continue through there, although that's easing off. With strong winds, basically from Cape Naturalist right along the south coast. And for tomorrow, we'll have a strong wind warning, probably from the Dampier Peninsula up around Broome right, to Barrow Island through that sort of southern Kimberley waters and off the Pilbara coast, so strong winds through there tomorrow, and probably see the strong winds ease off around the southeast coast in the morning, but come back ahead of Friday's front around the Cape Naturalist around to Albany area on Friday afternoon and evening.
James, some might say you're verbose, but I say you're thorough. Thank you so much.
Good on you, Belinda.
Let's have a look at the rainfall figures now, the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. We'll check 5 mils and over in northern and eastern forecast districts. The Gascoyne, Payne's Find 5. And that's it for that region. Let's move on to the South West Land Division and a different story. Quite a few to get through. The Central West, Arrowdale 8, Barberton 12, Barberton East 16, Ballandane 5, Bindi North 10, Balgata 6, Canna 7, Canterbury 18, Carnamar 5, Coolangatta 5, Karoo 7, Dandaragan West 22, Dongara 5, Eridu 7, Geraldton Airport 6, Hawathara 11, Durian Bay 9, Kalbarri 6, Latham 5, Mindella 8, Mingenew 7, Moasca 12, Morawa Airport 8, Nabawar 13, Eunorsia 17, Northampton 14, Riverside 6, Sand Springs 12, South Homewood 7, Tabletop 15, Tarden Hill 7, Three Springs 8, Tibraden 11, Walbing 14, Wandai 9, Yandanooka 6. The Lower West, Anketell 18, Bickley 32, Bindoon 28, Boggart Bin 14, Dwelling Up 29, Gidgegan Up 27, Huntley 23, Jandakot Aero 17, Jarrodale 28, Julimar Forest 22, Carnot 30, Carrigullen North 28, Lake Chittering had 30, Lancelin 12, Minston Park 31, Mooliabini 24, Moondah Brook 23, Mount Solis 31, Mushay 24, Mundaring 29, Noble Falls 30, Nunnall 14, Pierce Raft Base 20, Pickering Brook 30, Pinjarra South 11, Rolly Stone 31, Serpentine 21, 2J East 16, Wanneroo 17, Wattening 18, Werribee 22, Southwest Acton Park 9, Boyne Up North 7, Boyup Brook 13, Bridgetown 11, Brunswick Junction 7, Bunbury 8, Busselton Aero 6, Cape Lewin 7, Capel North 6, Chapman Hill 8, Collie 20, Collie East 19, Kawarram Up 5, Donnybrook 8, Donnybrook East 6, Doyle Road 7, Ferguson Valley 11, Happy Valley Alert 7, Hentybrook 11, Jarrowood 10, Jindong 8, Carrie Valley Research Station 13, Ludlow 7, Manjimup 18, Margaret River 8, Mount William 13, Nubicup 18, Northcliffe 25, Paindale Alert 8, Pemberton 17, Ravenscliff Alert 9, Shannon 25, Somme Creek 15, Thompson Brook 12, Walpole 19, Windy Harbour 22, Wychcliffe 16 and Yingarillup 7, just 7. Southern Coastal, Albany 13, the Airport 8, Amalup 8. Barrett Meadows 9, Bremer Bay 10, Chessalon 11, Chain Beach 11, Dalyup Park 12, Denbarker 16, Denmark 13, Erinair 6, Esperance 15, Esperance Aero 10, Hopetoun North 5, Jacup 5, Jerramungup 12 over 3 days, King River 13, Merivale Farm 10, Medler 7, Mount Barker 18, Narrakup West 12, Narrelup 7, Ongarup 7, Porongarup South 10, Ravensthorpe 7, Salmon Gums Research Station 6, Tamar 7, Tallina Downs 10, The Duke 13 and White Gums 12. Central Wheat Belt, Amory Acres 10, Ardeth 10, Balladoo 8, Belka 10, Bencubbin 9, Berea 5, Beverley 12, Bullfinch 9, Bungala 16, Kalgis 13, Kudanuppin 17, Cunderdon Airfield 13, Dalwallinu 7, Dungan Peak 11, Ijanding 10, Gabbin 11, Gemelling 13, Happy Valley 9, Hinds Hill 6, Caliberon 13, Cocodine 9, Condit 9, Conagoring 11, Coolyanobbing 5, Longforest 15, Meriden 8, Monongarren 9, Mount Hardy 9, Mount Noddy 13, Mount Westdale 14, Muckenbuden 6, Narrambeen 10, Noongar 9, Northam 16, Nungarren 7, Quadney 14, Quiriding 7, Seven Oaks 8, Shackleton 6, Southern Cross 5, Swanara 7, Tammin 10. Tallinning Hill 9, Training 6, Whale 14, Westonia 10, Wongan Hills 13, Woburn 5, Yangadine 8, Nattering 15, York 11 and York Rakine 7. Getting to our last one, the Great Southern, Amrista Park 9, Arthur River 15, Badgerbup 10, Bannister 21, Beaumont 11, Bonnington North 23, Burralee 8, Boscobel 9, Brookton 10, Broomhill 9, Bullie 9, Chamming Up 12, Cherry Tree 11, Coondee 16, Corrigan 9, Cranbrook 15, Cabelling 12, Colford 23, Darkin 20, Dumbleyung 10, Horseshoe 13, Hyden 6, Kojonalakin Hill 12, Kojanup 12, Kandinan 6, Cookerin 8, Lake Grace 12, Maradong 22, Mordetta 13, Narrogin 10, Newdigate Research Station 14, Nyabing 10, Pingelly 13, Pingerup 6, Riverdale 13, Tambalup 11, Wagen 13, Wandering 19, Wickapin 11, Wilgarra 16, Williams 15, Williams North 12, Woodenilling 14 and Yillering East 8.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
This is the Country Hour. It's 13 to 1. WA strawberry growers can once again export their fruit to Tasmania following the lifting of a temporary ban which was put in place earlier this month when three WA punnets were found to contain green snails. Biosecurity Tasmania says strawberries from properties more than 2 kilometres from an infestation can now be imported into Tasmania as long as a series of import conditions are met, and that includes monthly farm inspections to ensure the property is pest-free. The snails attack a wide range of leafy vegetables and also wheat, lupins, pasture and native plants. Neil Handerside is chair of the Strawberry Growers Association of WA. Neil, what have the growers learned from this detection of green snails?
Yeah, look, it's been a real, not a wake-up call, but it's certainly been a clear message that growers need to be aware of what's going on in their farms and obviously biosecurity on their own farms and biosecurity for what's going out off their farms. So, yeah, it's been a bit of a wake-up call, particularly for three growers, yes.
In that Wanneroo area?
Yes.
Where the snails were detected from, farms from that area. Now, yep. Biosecurity Tasmania is advising in its latest biosecurity advisory that a temporary import requirements have been imposed on the trade of WA strawberries going into Tasmania. And as a result, strawberries from properties more than 2 kilometres from a green snail infestation in this state can once again be imported into Tasmania. Does that mean strawberries are now moving from WA into Tasmania?
Look, I'm not 100% sure. I think there's probably been a bit of a wait and see how the market goes. But it's open and it's an avenue if the market pressures are there for the growers to make a profit to send to Tasmania. So. Yeah, it's good to have that gate open again.
And what are the protocols in place now? I mean, where are those inspections for the green snails occurring? Here in WA, or does that happen at the other end, at Tasmania's end, or both?
It would happen both. There's inspections on the farm and the farms to be checked, and also obviously going out from the state. And then obviously each state has its own biosecurity checks and balances in place. So. Yeah, Tasmania will be checking them, I'm sure.
How difficult is it to detect these green snails?
Not difficult at all. They're green. They obviously they change colour a little bit when they get from a young snail to an older snail. But, you know, they're green. They're quite different to the garden brown snail that most people will have some in their backyard.
And are they often found in strawberries here in WA?
No, they're not. And there's a fairly good map of where they are. And they're mainly in the metro area and a little bit north and a little bit inland as well, and in basically small isolated areas. But certainly the metro area, they're, And they're in pockets as well. They're sort of not over the whole area, but just mainly in the northern part of the metro area.
So for you as a grower in Albany, it's not an issue?
Not at this point in time, but you've got to have biosecurity on your farm and make sure you know what's coming in and the equipment and anything that could come on a pallet of product from a farm that has it, you know, so you just got to be aware.
Have you been looking more closely for the green snails since this came to light?
Well, we've had nothing. We're completely not picking at all yet, and so nothing's moving in and out. So, but, yeah, certainly will be.
I'm sure. Now, where would the strawberries that would have been going to Tasmania from that, you know, Wanneroo area that would have normally been going over to Tasmania, where have they ended up? Have they been just put onto the domestic market here in Western Australia?
Look, I'm sure that happened a little bit for the first few days after the ban, but yeah, the production has lifted as well as the spring or the season's developed. But internationally, there's been a lot more focus on export and sending to Southeast Asia and into the Middle East area.
And so there wouldn't have been extra strawberries on the market, on the domestic WA market, as a result of that temporary ban that was put in place from Tasmania?
No, Tasmania is it's a small, pretty small market, and I was actually surprised that there was WA strawberries going into Tasmania, let alone to know that there was green snails on them. So yeah, it was a little bit new to me, but basically the extra strawberries that people might see in the shops now are just basically, you know, more supply from just normal plant growth in the season that develops every year.
So just a couple of hot days might have just brought on that flush that we've noticed in the supermarkets and shops.
Sure, yep.
Where do most of our strawberries go? Can you give us the split between the consumption here on the WA market and interstate and overseas?
It changes, the mix changes a little bit for the year, but generally 30% of the production would go into the metro area, into, you know, WA, and then 30 to 40% goes to the eastern states, into Sydney, Melbourne and the like. And then we do, you know, overseas export of probably 30 to 40% of the product as well.
And is that where the big bucks are, right, into those export markets?
Not necessarily. There's some areas of markets that are really good, but it basically keeps things moving, and there've been markets that we've had for a long, long time, and the industry's keen to keep them. The Middle East has, you know, been a developing market as Dubai and as a stopover point of flying to Europe. So, you know, it's been growing quite considerably.
All right, great to talk to you today. Thanks so much for being part of the Country Hour today.
Okay, no worries. Thank you.
Neil Handerside from the Strawberry Growers Association of WA, 7 to 1. 8 different projects designed to improve the lives of young people in the bush will be piloted in regional communities thanks to a major financial boost. The projects were launched at an event in Melbourne where winners from the ABC's Haywire competition got the chance to meet the people who'll be bringing their ideas to life. Clint Jasper was there.
19 councils and community groups will share in $150,000 from the Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal to launch pilots of the projects. Each year, the ABC sends young people from around Australia to Canberra to develop ideas for developing their communities. And this year, like it has in the past, the FRRR throws its support behind the ideas to help bring them to life. CEO Natalie Eggleton.
The program allows young people to step into their leadership roles in their communities, and we can back it by bringing a lot of other philanthropists to the table and getting behind them to encourage them, support them and enable their ideas to be catalysed. So each year we see new breeds of young people coming through with brilliant ideas, which then gets extended out into rural communities around Australia, and other young people then get to leverage those ideas. So it has such a multifaceted range of benefits, and we can just see the dollar going a really long way, and there's a lot of value in it for both us, the communities that are supported by the grants, and the donor partners as well.
Have you noticed, as your own grant program has matured, more councils and community groups are expressing interest in applying for money from that pool?
Yes, we have a really strong level of demand. This year we received over 30 applications from around the country, and we do see over time, an increase in the partnership level that occurs in the communities with young people partnering with councils or local businesses or other not-for-profit organisations. So that's evolving and maturing as the program grows. And the other exciting thing is that as the program is growing and we're starting to see the impacts of the grants, we're getting more donor partners on board. So we've welcomed at least three new donor partners this year. So the program is growing in dollar size as well as its reach.
One of the eight successful ideas from the 2016 Haywire Summit was Dot to Dot, developed in part by Geelong's Finbar Kinner.
It's connecting disconnected or disengaged youth in rural areas with volunteering in their community based around their interests.
How did this idea come about?
This idea came about over about a week of just solid thinking between me and a group of other lovely young people, thinking about what we could do to make a difference in our community. We all had a background in either being part of volunteering or having helped at volunteering through school, and it just sort of made sense to connect people with their community through volunteering.
Now, Kim Hesloff is here from the Northern Grampians Shire Council. That elevator pitch was obviously very attractive to your youth group. What made you run with it?
Well, I guess connecting the youth in Stawell is a real priority for us. Just getting people out and engaged and involved and building the resilience of young people in Stawell is something that the Northern Grampian Shire Youth Action Council are really passionate about, and it just seemed to fit what we're doing really well.
Kim Hesloff with Clint Jasper. The Goldfield City of Kalgoorlie-Boulder was the only WA recipient of that Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal and Haywire grant funding. It received $10,000 for a youth mentoring program matching school-age students with community members under the age of 30 to help with that transition from secondary education. The city's community development team leader, Tanya Gartner, explains how it will work.
We're looking at implementing it over across the next 18 months. What we'll be doing is matching those mentors with the secondary students who will be able to help them with providing guidance and support for them to transition from school through to further study and into the workforce and what that might look like for them.
How important is it that this happens in the community of Kalgoorlie-Boulder? What will it do for it?
I think it's really important. It will sort of help empower young people to make positive decisions for themselves and to create opportunities to investigate and explore where they want to go and how that's going to happen. So we're really excited that it's a great new idea for the all of Kalgoorlie-Boulder community.
And obviously being the only recipient of Haywire FRRR funding in Western Australia, $10,000, is that enough or does the city have to kick in a bit of money as well? How will it work?
We're anticipating that it will be covered under that. The city will provide the support of the youth worker, the youth counsellor, and other costs that might crop up with that, like catering and uniforms or any sort of memorabilia that we want to create.
Tanya Gardner from the City of Kalgoorlie-Boulder with Tara de Langraft. 2:01. We're off to Mount Barker now for the results of the cattle market. And Tracy Kilner, a small yarding of just 311 today.
Yes, a small yarding dominated by yearlings with limited cattle suitable for slaughter. Bullocks over 600 kilos returned 292 cents a kilo. Grown steers weighing 5 to 600 kilos made 292 cents a kilo. And grown heifers over 500 kilos were up 15 cents, making 251 to 288 cents a kilo. Yearling steers gained again this week to finish with heavyweights selling for 350 to 369 cents, averaging 360 cents a kilo. And the medium weights made 338 to 366 cents, averaging 352 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers eased 5 to 20 cents, with the heavyweights selling from 250 to 295 cents a kilo. Medium weights made 270 to 320 cents a kilo to remain firm, and the lightweights sold from 251 to 302 cents a kilo. Prime 3 and 4 score cows were up 15 cents, selling for 197 to 233 cents, averaging 220 cents a kilo. While the medium weight cows sold for 218 to 240 cents, finishing up 20 cents, and the lighter cows only made 185 cents a kilo. Bulls regained on last week, with heavy bulls selling from 215 to 234 cents a kilo, and the lightweight bulls made 200 to 341 cents a kilo. A number of calves were sold by appraisal, with Angus, veal or steer selling for $600 to $800, and the heifers for $620 a head. First cross Angus Frisian steers made $695, while the first cross heifers sold for $710 to $840 a head, and straight Frisian steers made $630 to $650 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. And just a reminder, the Kimberley's biggest bull sale on tomorrow at Fitzroy Crossing. A massive 195 bulls on offer. 1 o'clock.